everyone. I'm Jen Nelson, and this is From Cloud to Cab. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about soil health with Jimmy Emmons, who is an Oklahoma farmer and a soil health champion, and Blaine Hitchens, who is just getting started the past few years into adopting soil health practices on his farm here in Sussex County. Jimmy came out to Delaware Ag Week in January and spoke at the soil health session there. And one of the things that I really liked about his presentation, and when I've seen him talk before, is how he can break down soil health concepts and just explain them in a way that's very understandable. So Blaine had some ideas that he wanted to kick around with Jimmy and some questions that he wanted to ask, and they get into a really good conversation about what some of those soil health concepts look like in this region versus Oklahoma. They talk about some management details like the number of species that you should be looking for and seeding rates.
But yeah, I mean, you can simulate Mother Nature however you want to. As long as you mimic what she's doing, then you're in regenerative ag.
They talk about farm economics, how they relate to soil health in terms of yield versus profitability.
But I like to talk about profitability. My banker really loves to talk about profitability.
That's all that matters.
They also get into a little bit about soil health and legacy and how you can talk to somebody who's had a successful farming operation, even for generations, about how they still might seek to make changes on their operation and improve their soil health. With that, I will let them introduce themselves and enjoy.
Here today, and thanks for the invitation. So Jimmy Emmons from Northwest Oklahoma, just below the Panhandle, about 40 miles and about 30 miles from Texas. So in a 22 inch rainfall area, if anyone would know what an average is anymore. So we have 2,000 acres of production land and about 6,000 acres of range land where we run a cow-calf operation on. Typically, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, we were one to two crop harvest, so mainly wheat, hard red and winter wheat, and some alfalfa. And we used to grow cotton, but we kind of got away from that till we grow nine different crops right now, and the goal is 12. So.
Okay. All right. And so I think maybe the first question that I had was when you are, well, what does your soil health program look like? Let me start with that.
So my soil health program looks like the first and foremost that I think about is what I do on top of the land. How does it affect not only the surface, but the biology and the carbon that's in the soil. Carbon is the key, but it's all tied to organic matter. Nationwide, we've lost half of our topsoil and half of our organic matter, at least. Out where I live, it's even worse than that.
I have heard that.
So, you know, typically, most everybody's less than 1% organic matter, 0.5%. I had some sandy ground that was in 4.5% and to really understand that water holding capacity for every 1% is 20 to 25,000 gallons of water. It depends on your soil and soil type, and that varies a little bit, say 20,000 gallons. So if you've eroded half of that away, you have lost the ability to store half of the water that you could and take in a heavy rainfall event, and then use that during the dry periods to live on. So that gives your resilience in the system. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think, is how do I grow carbon and how do I maintain that? If I'm planting soybeans and I'm going to burn quite a bit of carbon with the beans, you know, how do I replace that? What crops do I replace? and how to stagger that. So it's a complex sounding, but it's really not once you get into it.
Okay. So I know the title of your talk tonight is Recovering Tillage Addict.
Yeah.
So you've got kind of a basic, I mean, you've got a no-till system and you use cover crops. I mean, what kind of cover crops do you use, or what are your goals with building carbon? But what do you use to do that?
So we started out with summer covers because we're in a cool season area, mainly wheat. So, you know, being part of the recovering tillage part of that is also recovering from the mindset of we just got to grow wheat. But that's where I started. So I would start with the warm season mixes right behind harvest. Now, we started out with a 3 or 4 way blend because I wasn't comfortable with putting more blends in, and I didn't know what and how. And so it's kind of a learning process. Then I started seeing the benefits. And it's like, wow, I need more nitrogen. I need more legumes. I need more carbon. I need more grasses. My soil's not porous enough, so I need more brassicas in there. And so we kind of settled on around a 15, 16 way blend. I planted up into 32, 33 different species.
Wow.
Yeah, that worked very well, but I didn't see the a lot of extra benefits at that 30, 32 species than I did at a 20.
Okay.
So I've kind of narrowed back down to about 16 to 20.
Okay.
That's not saying that I won't continue to experiment and put that in, because really the diversity of the species lessens your risk for failure. So if I only plant one forage sorghum sedan out there,
okay,
maybe it doesn't perform well in all the parts of my field, and so then it's very thin there. But if I had four different mixes in there, then they're going to be more prolific. The more you get, the less risk you have of failure of that cover crop in achieving the goal that you set out. So that's something that we had to learn with our warm season mixes. Once we kind of got where we could really load the system with 10, 12, 14, 16,000 pounds of biomass with a warm season and still go back to a cool season, then we started playing with cool season mixes so we could grow some summer covers, because our weather pattern in Oklahoma has changed and our rains are coming at different periods, heavier events, more violent events. So then we started where we have some cool season mixes, some warm season mixes, and that's the reason I'm growing so many different crops now.
Are you trying to time that biomass for when you're expecting some of those extreme weather events, or just like more biomass in general to buffer events whenever they happen to occur?
Well, I've never seen a weatherman that can accurately predict when we're going to have them events. There is, you know, used to be May was a heavy time period for us. Now it's not. So no, I don't do it for the weather. I do it for the overall season.
Long term. Okay. Yep. Now, when you were talking about following up soybeans or a legume, something that takes carbon out of the soil, it got me to thinking, because a lot of our rotation in this area is a corn and soybean rotation, and trying to figure out where your mixes come in. You know, if you're coming off of soybeans, one kind of perspective there is that you can plant a legume to follow it up, because you're going to follow it with corn. So you're trying to supply a lot of nitrogen to the following
corn crop.
Now, with what you're saying there, though, that it seems like it might be advisable to try and plant, you know, something that has a lot of biomass, something like rye or, you know, a grain that can help replace that carbon. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, sometimes people don't like to plant rye, plant corn into rye, just because of the grass and the type sometimes of the end. But once again, in the mix, you don't want that dominant. So if you're really wanting more in, you want more dominant leg games. And I would suggest more than one leg game.
And now that I'm saying that, I'm assuming that you can even get into the field after you get a soybean crop off so that you have the opportunity to plant cover crops. But
sure. And you know, you can fly on. You can spread on like we saw here with the district right. with a air seeder in that green crop. And then with that drop leaf, you get the coverage on that. And especially in your rainfall area, that's a lot more successful. I'm more challenged in Oklahoma. Because you do have to have the surface moisture conditions for that fly on or drop on to work. But yes, like this year is a very challenging year for a huge part of the country of too wet.
Right.
I was in Des Moines, Iowa, and drove up from Oklahoma last week, and I saw lots of beans in the field, corn, cotton still in the field due to wet conditions. Now, where I do see the greatest benefits is if you get your structure of your soil good and your profile and your aggregation working right, you can actually get on them fields without rutting up a lot. And so most of them fields were harvested. Understanding that aggregation and infiltration and carbon in the soil is very key to that. And I just can't stress that enough.
Yep, and I think, Blaine, what are some of your thoughts on what you've heard so far?
Is there a time frame when you want to have your cover crop planted by to get the maximum out of it before the next planting season?
Well, I say this every time I speak. I would like the drill to be running in the field when I'm harvesting or done have it planted if you have that luxury. So the quicker the better. Totally different area than you're in here. So once we open the canopy up with harvest, we start drying the surface off. Mm-hmm. So our success rate of an established stand starts diminishing every day due to evaporation from that. So the quicker, the better. But as I told some of the group last night, I had cereal rye laid in the ground 110 days last year before it germinated due to drought.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a total failure. But we caught some snows and some rains, and lo and behold, it came in the spring and really provided me some forage after we had a wildfire. So always plant. Always have the goal of planting as quick as you can. And of course, I like more diversity. There is people that like a mono cover, and I say a cover is better than none. And I think if you want to start out with cereal rye or single mix, that's fine. But I think once you start tweaking and experimenting, start small, do some plot work, side-by-side comparisons, you'll find out that diversity is your friend.
With on that topic of diversity, what do you see in terms of benefits when you're planting three species or two species versus when you're planting five species versus when you're, I know you were talking about that you have less of a chance of a cover crop failure. But is there something, I guess, that you can pencil out with that or what does that look like?
So what I've really decided is you need to look at your setting on your farm or your area. We drove by several wooded areas this morning here, and I asked, you know, is this typical, is this native, or is this planted? Well, this is native. So I would stop there, and I would try to figure out how many species is growing naturally in that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where you need to start thinking about how can I mimic that on my farm ground. So if the natural number, say, is 10 here,
mm-hmm.
then I would try to target 10.
That's a good target.
Yeah. If it's 30, maybe you try 30. Maybe 30 doesn't work. Once again, you've got to fix it for your local area, your farm, your goals, because every one of us has a different goal. Mm. We may all have this common goal of raising commodity grain whatever it is, or beef or chicken or whatever, but we do it differently with a different goal in mind. So that's something you got to keep in mind.
How do you determine the rates of when you leave from, say, three different species and you take them same three and add five more to it? How do you determine the rate that you should be working with every time you add a species on?
So there's an online calculator that I use, mm-hmm. With green cover. It's free. That's a seed company in the Midwest that allows you to do that. And so you put your goals in there, how much N I want to fix, how much drought tolerance I want to fix. There's several different goals. So then you start down through there with that mix and you say, oh, I want 6 pounds of this, I want 4 pounds of this. And then it starts calculating your goals. And it's like, wow, I'm short of nitrogen. I'll back up and go from 6 pounds to 8 pounds or 10 pounds of legume here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start balancing that out as you go. And at the same time, it's calculating dollars per acre.
Oh, yeah.
Over there. And, you know, this doesn't work for everybody, but in our area, in a 20-inch rainfall, a lot of people in the Midwest want to talk about pounds per acre. I would say stay within your rainfall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you want to talk plants, about 450 to 475,000 plants for a warm season for us in that 20-inch rainfall really works good. But I tell everybody that comes and gets seed, go out, and if you're going to put on 450,000 seeds, run you a pass or two down through there, turn around and double that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you stop and cut that drill back a third and do side-by-side comparisons and see what the difference is at your place. And then quickly, if you'll do that a few times, quickly you'll come to the
conclusion,
yes, that I want to be at X,
yep.
Whatever that is. I get the question all the time, you know, what should I plant? How much should I plant? Well, I can tell you what I do at my place.
Yes.
That will not apply here.
Mm-mm. It shouldn't.
No. And so that's the hard part. Typically as producers, and I've been there, we like the easy button.
To follow the leader.
Yep. You can do that a little bit to start with if you're very uncomfortable about mixing your own. But I say if you start that way, do your own work on your own place, mm-hmm. and adjust that from the general mix. And that's basically what I done. My first mixes, I let my local DC and my state soil scientist help me kind of sit down with some goals, and we come up with this mix, and I planted it, and it's like, I need a little bit more of this, and this done a little better here. And then I went to tweaking it myself,
mm-hmm.
until I come up with the Jimmy Emmons mix.
Yes.
So
that naturally works for you,
mm-hmm.
on your Oklahoma farm.
Yep.
And I think that leads me into something that I wanted to talk about, and this is a question for both of you, really. You know, because I think that everybody needs to figure out what works on their farm, you know, and so I know you've gotten to a point where you have practices that maybe look far and away different from what people are practicing here, you know, really tall covers, you know, and grazing on them and things like that. How do you get into that incrementally? How do you decide what you want to test on your farm, both of you guys? And how do you go about testing it to see if it's a good fit for your operation? Blaine, why don't we start with you?
Well, 3 years ago, we started with the rye. 4 years ago, we started with the rye program for soybeans,
mm-hmm.
because that was like the big thing. Everybody was planting rye for soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And that works really great because of the nodules that the rye puts on to release the nitrogen to the soybeans. It works. And for the corn crop, I really didn't care for it because when the corn comes up, it's searching for sunlight, and it don't have the color.
So you're talking about laying it down, like planting rye and trying to follow it, like,
yeah,
either lay it down or plant into it. Like, how do those interactions
work? Or killing it early,
okay.
So it doesn't get the big growth to it for corn, because corn is a It's a sunlight machine. It's got to have it to build photosynthesis to create them carbons.
That's correct.
Or them carbohydrates. And then we, a local farmer, I was watching him because he's been messing with the vetches for 5-6 years now. I was like, that looks like that works. Because when you plant into your vetch, you lay it over. The planter will lay it down like carpet, and it the corn, you have to plant it a half inch deeper or so because you're the mat.
Yeah.
But when it comes up, it's automatically in the sunlight. And now you've got a 3 to 5 inch mass of vetch laying right on that ground.
With heavy end to feed the
yes,
corn.
Yes, the corn.
Yeah.
And now, this year I figured I sprayed one time on two farms, didn't use Roundup neither time.
Yep.
I went out there with my straight, which would actually be my second spraying of Lexar and atrazine. I sprayed that the first time, never returned, and had no weed pressure, no, it was just beautiful.
Yeah, it's the weed pressure is directly correlated to the thickness of the
yes.
thatch, if you want to call it that, on the top. To answer part of your question with the rye in corn, I've got a good friend in Manchester, Tennessee, in Coffee County. As a local DC there, is really leading the state of Tennessee in covers and biomass. And what they do is they plant their corn in the standing, and then they roll it within a day or two with their rye down.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have their corn readily available to the sunlight
yes.
when it comes up.
Smart.
And great success at that. So
well, this
that's
year,
something to think about.
This year, when I planted my vetch, I planted 20 pounds to the acre, but I put like 4 pounds of rye to the acre with it,
mm-hmm.
along with 5 or 6 pounds of radishes.
Yeah, there you go.
So now, looking into this year, my rye is going to grow, and the vetch is going to climb it. So now I'm going to get a taller biomass, but it's not going to be as rank. And when I lay it over, the vetch is going to lay the rye with it.
Yeah.
And it'll be same scenario, but I don't have that 50 pounds of rye out there creating all that havoc.
Yeah.
So you're kind of making little tweaks across your whole farm
yes.
every year is how you're...
This year...
Like adapting over
I've
time.
I've done 2 farms with 3 species,
mm-hmm.
and the other farms... but I got vetch on every acre, even for my soybeans, because I've just fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the rye is blended with it, but 2 farms I put the radishes with the vetch and the rye.
Okay.
So he's actually doing what I was just describing earlier. He's applying and learning from his own work on his own farm
right.
to get to where it fits his goal. And he now knows that I don't like the standing rye, and he likes the hairy vetches in there, so it lays it down. So see, he's learning. That's exactly what I preach.
And I'm all about my plants have to have sunlight. I don't want no shade. That's why I want that cover crop flattened just as soon as it's planted, and the vetch will pull it all to the ground.
Yeah,
because it's all wrapped right up together.
Now, that works really good, like you said, for beans and corn and for summer crops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at home, if we're going to plant a cereal grain into residue, I like quite a bit of it standing because we get snow, and normally when we get snow at home, we get a lot of wind.
Yep.
And so I'm, once again, in a challenged moisture area. So I want to capture all the moisture. So I like my wintertime standing. Plus, if I'm going to graze that cool season with cattle, most people will feed hay if they're on a cereal grain for some dry matter. I don't have to do that because I've got it standing out in the field. Less cost.
But how do you kill that cover crop once you plant the cereal into it?
So... We do use some Roundup in them type scenarios. Gramoxone a little bit. I have frosted out.
Let it die on its own.
Yep.
And the wheat or rye will keep right on coming.
Sure. But once again, in an arid climate, you have to watch that because that time of year, your warm seasons are in reproductive mode and they're using a lot more water. So, you know, you got to be cautious of that, and you kind of got to learn planting dates if you're going to do that. So don't plant early that warm season, which mm-hmm. goes against what I just said earlier. But sometimes we might do two plantings.
Okay. Plant your regular cereal first and then your cover after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, there's just things you got to learn there. But that's a challenge in our area, that if you were in a 30 or 40-inch rainfall, that might not be an issue. Yeah. But once again,
what is our average rainfall here?
I think it's about 40, 45
42,
inches.
42,
yeah. So, see, double.
Yeah.
And where our land, we're only working with 6 to 8 inches of topsoil. And we've seen over the years, just where we planted rye 3 or 4 years back to back, how that ground just got more mellow.
Oh, yeah.
Softer. And it looks like when we spread our manure or when we pull out there with a pickup, it looks like it's sinking, but it levels back off. Yep.
Yeah.
It all works its way back to a level playing field.
When you get your soil right, I like to refer to it as water.
Mm-hmm.
So you can lay a boat in the water and you cause a ripple. But in a minute or a few minutes, it levels back out.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to watch that work. You touched on a couple of really good points there about aggregation and water infiltration there, as you was describing that, and the thatch. So the bigger the aggregation is in that soil, the more water you can take. But it also gives you that cushion, mm-hmm. that feel when you walk out. And I can tell when I walk out on fields, because it's just like either, you know, we used to have shag carpet was a big thing mm-hmm. when I grew up. And if you had a double pad underneath that when you walked on it, it was just extremely soft.
Yep.
And that's the way our fields, when you walk out there, you feel that. And so when I have people come and we travel around as we're walking out there, I ask them, do you feel anything? And immediately they start feeling that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you know, and that's when your earthworms and your biology are really active in the profile. And, you know, that's the living body that we really need to understand.
Feeding.
And feed that to the maximum that you can. And partner with it, because it's going to help you create nutrients that you don't have to buy.
Because everything we need is underneath of our feet.
That's correct.
And especially on the Eastern Shore here, where we are loaded with chicken manure.
Yep.
And we've got all the organic compost we need to grow any crop sufficiently.
Yeah. See, I don't have that luxury. I'd love to have some of that litter and manures close to me. But that's the reason I use animals at high stock density to create my own.
That's right.
It's I can't get the poundage that you can, but it's natural, and we like to use that. And sometimes I use that as a termination of the warm season. If I can put enough stock density on there, I can get that roller crimp with the hoof out
mm-hmm.
and kill that. Plus, I get the urine and the manure as close as we can to one another.
I have wondered about that. You know, because I think grazing cover crops is picking up a lot of steam in a regenerative ag in general. And we don't have that here, but I have wondered if the poultry litter that we have available is, you know, acting as a substitute, you know, doing the same kind of job. We don't have the same kind of incorporation or the same kind of disturbance because the grazing action itself.
Yeah.
You know, but like how much of a parallel is there with that?
Yeah, there's definitely some benefits to that. You know, what the grazing really does is especially is like cattle, they pull and bite. That mm-hmm. stimulates the plant and the roots and leak more exudates. And it feeds the biology. Plus, you get a little hoof action in there and a little disturbance on top to work some of that in. But once again, you got to manage that as heavy on, long period off.
Mm-hmm.
But you can simulate Mother Nature however you want to. As long as you mimic what she's doing, then you're in regenerative ag. And, you know, I preach very heavily about animals back on the land. That's the way it was originally set up. The problem with that is most America has got away from the animals, clear up to the Midwest and the corn and the wheat belt. There's very little infrastructure of fencing and water back for that. That's something they need to be looking at, because that's also another revenue stream. Mm-hmm. And agriculture, you know, is really struggling now. I don't need to tell anybody that. But any entrepreneur or millionaire will tell you have to have at least 7 streams of revenue to be successful, to grow.
Interesting.
And wow. So if you're only harvesting 1 or 2 crops and no animals, you're limiting mm-hmm. the stream of income coming in. So that's the reason I'm at 9 different crops. Now, can I raise all 9 in 1 year? Some years I can, some years I can't. How I juggle my acres around, but I've also got cows, calves, you know, seed, multiple things there, trying to get more streams of revenue coming in and that's profitable.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like to talk about yield. That yield is mm-hmm. the most common word used in mm-hmm. production agriculture. No matter where I go, I got the question asked last night, what kind of yields do you have?
Right.
And some of that's culture and heritage that we don't want to talk about how much we got of money.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to talk about profitability. My banker really loves to talk about profitability.
That's all that matters.
And really that is the business model that matters is, you know, I love what I do. I think we all do across America, and we wouldn't do anything else. But the bottom line is we all have to sustain in our families and our luxury of life at whatever level you want to be at. And so to do that, it takes revenue, and that's got to be positive revenue mm-hmm. in profit. You can't, you know, everybody's cash flow is great. But you've got to have cash flow for the system to function. But if it doesn't have black ink on it, cash flow does you no good.
I think that's
now getting
a good
back
point.
To the chicken manure thing.
Mm-hmm.
Our land is, we've got a lot of metals in it,
mm-hmm.
which all land's got a lot of metals. But we are very high on aluminums around here because our poultry litter is, a lot of it is loaded with aluminum because that's what we use for ammonia control. These cover crops, will they help mineralize that out of the soil to break down the chicken manure faster for plant productivity?
Yeah, you know, I haven't addressed that specific thing at home. But yeah, that's the process of the biology is to break that down. It's what we need to start looking at, and a lot of researchers are looking at this, microbiologists across the country right now, is what biology you have, mm-hmm. what do you need to feed that biology to make it more dominant. So identifying the biology that would break aluminum down would be really, really keen in here, so then that you could feed that biology with the living root what it needs to break the aluminum down.
To separate it.
To separate it out, make it more available. Mm-hmm. Same with phosphorus
yep.
and all that. So it's that process. They're there. They just may not be in abundant numbers that you need for the amount of aluminum that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can facilitate their growth, then that will help you. I mean, the biology is just like the human race. It's so similar under the ground how they trade for different nutrients
yep.
and what they need and what they like and what they feed on, much like what we are. And so, you know, if you really want me to be hyped up tonight and really talk a long time, a good Dr. Pepper and a Hershey's candy bar before I talk, and I might talk to midnight tonight. If you want me to be calm and collected and put everybody to sleep, maybe it's a bigger, fuller meal. You got to think of the biology.
Is your tank half full or half empty?
Yes, And you got to think of it as the race below the ground of the biology of being so similar to us and how that system works. If you get to that point that you understand that everything I do to my land has a consequence.
It does.
Everything.
Yep.
And typically in American agriculture, we do not think about the consequence that we have and the rippling effect down the road it has on the biology, which is our friend for our nutrients and our living.
Mm-hmm.
And it's directly correlated, the healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy food, healthy bodies.
Mm-hmm.
In whatever, healthy bodies of animals mm-hmm. and of humans. And so whatever we consume of animal products then is healthy. Once you understand that, then the system building becomes easier because you're more focused on that. And if you look at the trend of chemical and synthetic fertilizer and our health as a nation, there's a direct correlation of the increase of that has increased the health issues that we have. And so it's directly tied to the soil.
As I said last night, World War II before, pre-World War II, all the land was way healthier versus post-World War II.
Yep.
Everything started going downhill.
Yep.
Because the changes, the farming practices went more conventional, which they were conventional before that, but they were all cover crops. They did a lot of plowing and but they were building their humuses and their organic matter in the soil by plowing down the crops.
So I talk about that in my talks a lot. You know, I'm third generation on our family farm. So Granddad moved there in 1926. Granddad was an innovator.
Mm-hmm.
He had the first tractor in Dewey County. He had the first rubber tire tractor in Dewey County. He was very keen on the
trend setting.
Yep, up front. I guess that's maybe where I get that from. And I say he done the best job he could do with the technology that he had then. And he could never have planted in the biomass that I'm planting in with the equipment that was available.
Exactly.
So my granddad and my dad done a great job with the resources they had. And they did not know what they were doing. They would have never, never destroyed their soil if they knew they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that with all my heart. But that doesn't mean that we need to continue that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't always have to do it the way that they have done it. That's the hard part to get over. But it can be done. And it's... I see this a lot across the country, that heritage, having that undertow that, you know, I've been very successful at this and I need to do it this way. There's nothing wrong with getting advice from granddad and dad. But once again, my granddad talked about that before he died when he was 92, that he followed a horse with a walking plow and he got to see man land on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you put that in context of what I've seen in my lifetime, to what my son will see and what my grandson will see, you know, you've got to evolve. I don't want to be following a walking plow today. We talked about destruction of the soil, though. The rate that my granddad done of destruction was very slow because he was... You know, the biggest tractor he ever owned was an A. John Deere.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't plow very many acres very quick.
Mm-hmm.
Then my dad went from a 30-20 John, or an A. John Deere to a 30-20 and on up to 200 horsepower. Dad could plow a lot more acres, a lot more times,
mm-hmm.
with a lot more destruction. Now we're at 400, 500, 600 horsepower in huge equipment. I, if I wanted to, could do more in 1 year than they could have done in a decade.
Lifetime.
Yeah. So that's what we got to think about.
But in my, what I'm implementing on our farm, I'm bringing our structure back full circle, but not plowing it.
Yep.
I'm coming right back to what my grandfather done back in the 50s, and we're implementing the vetches, the ryes. Mm-hmm. That was there too. They didn't worry about what you're figuring out now. We need 6, 7, 10, 12. They worried about their vetch and their rye because that was their main source of food back to that plant because they had chicken manure, and that was what chicken manure, the vetch, the rye, and it worked.
Yep. Yeah, that's...
And now we've got equipment, we can not even touch it, plant through it, leave it there, let all the biomass rot right into the soil surface.
Yep. So, you know, I was in Nebraska a few years ago, and I got done talking, and an older gentleman said, "Jimmy, that's a really good talk, but, you know, I live west of here in a drier climate than you're in, and that just won't work here." And I said, "Really? Could we have a conversation?" And he said, "Sure." And I said, "So do you have any native range in your area?" "Yes." I said, "So you till that native range to take water?" "No." "Okay. Do you fertilize that native grass to make more forage?" "No." I said, "Okay. Do you just have a mono system of grass out there?" "No." And he told me exactly how many species, and it depended on where you measured, but anywhere from 100 to 300 different species in his ranch. And I said, So I've been talking today about keeping it covered, like your native range, no disturbance or minimal, just like your native range, with no need of synthetic fertilizer or chemicals, and a green living root in the ground as long as Mother Nature will allow it. In different climates, it's going to allow different days, but just as long as she'll allow it. A lot of us have the luxury of 365. Up north doesn't have that chance. So, you know, them five principles of soil health really dominate how the system works, and it was really set up in Mother Nature's way to do that. And he said, "You know, Jimmy, I never thought of it that way." And I said, "Most production agriculture today does not." Just something to think about.
I think that's perfect. I think we're probably running out of time today, but I really want to thank both of you, Jimmy and Blaine, for joining me today. Anything that we didn't get to that we've just got to say before we call it a day?
Just keep on plugging.
Sounds good.
Yep. And long live the soil.
All right.
Because that's the life of the earth.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, and we will see you next time.